Okay. So I'll go ahead and introduce our speaker tonight. Katie Gray is an acoustician with Stantec, a top-tier global architecture and engineering design firm. Her job is to make buildings sound good. She does this through her impressive knowledge of acoustics, supported by more than 20 years of musical training and experience in the violin and viola. Katie additionally has experience working in psychoacoustics research at the Johns Hopkins University. She has worked on all types of projects in architectural acoustics, including recording studios, theaters, schools, hospitals, and commercial offices. Katie holds an MA in acoustics from the Peabody Institute of the Johns Hopkins University and a BM in violin performance from Towson University. So without further ado, please welcome Katie Gray.
All right. So acoustics, that's black magic. And I picked that title because architects tell me this all the time. It's fun. They're so focused on the visuals. It's I think they have a hard time with it sometimes. But so architectural acoustics, like, what is it and why is it important, right? So we go through our whole lives going through these different acoustic environments. And most of it we spend inside. We're probably, like, you know, 75% of the time, most of us are inside all the time. So architectural acoustics has a big impact. It has a big impact on, like, how comfortable your day-to-day life is. You know, you spend your day in your house where hopefully it's nice and quiet, you don't hear your neighbors, and then maybe you go to the office where hopefully you don't hear, you know, the people chatting on the phone that's sitting right next to your desk. And then maybe you go out to a restaurant afterwards where these days is quite noisy and loud inside, and I wish they would go for some squishier materials on the walls and ceiling, but that's a hard sell. It's not popular at the moment. So architectural acoustics is really important. And the people who do that are acoustical consultants or acousticians. I had to practice saying that, by the way, like the first time I did that. So We're the people who architects hire, or other engineers, or clients who think acoustics are important to make a building sound good. I like to think of it as essentially, in some ways, we've been hired to design a giant musical instrument. It's just we're trying to do different things with sound than musical instruments are. So architectural acoustics itself can be sort of broken down into several categories. These sort of four overall categories is what our firm does. And just to give an introduction to Stantec, I started here back when it was Sparling too, actually. I was here for like 6 months maybe before Stantec acquired us. And Stantec does a lot of other things too. We have electrical engineers, mechanical engineering. We have architecture, not in this area, but in other parts of the country. But our group, there's about 10 of us, and we focus on this. And interior acoustics, we sort of break down further. We have it acoustic isolation and separation, and then room acoustics. A lot of people for the acoustic isolation like to call it soundproofing. We don't like that because it's without like a vacuum, it's really hard to completely soundproof a room. Like theoretically, there's no way that we can remove noise entirely from the equation, at least without, you know, people needing to breathe. So we generally go with acoustic isolation. But we also work with just sort of general environmental noise. This is the noise you hear outside. Most of the time when we're working with it, we're more looking to see what the impact of the outside noise is to inside a building. And then we do noise control and vibration control. And that's usually more related to like a building's mechanical systems, their HVAC equipment, heating, ventilation, and air conditioning. Because those are all pretty noisy, and though they provide important functions, again, they're getting you air and water into the building, we're trying to make that comfortable, too. So acoustic separation can be looked at in a lot of ways. I like this image because a lot of times when people think soundproofing, they think just the walls, but you really want to think above and below as well. Although I think people who live in apartments definitely think above and below. I don't know how many people have lived below a neighbor that you hear walking around whenever. at least I certainly have. And then sometimes, depending on the type of noise, you can actually get sort of weird noise paths from further in the building. So when we're looking at acoustic separation, we'll recommend different types of walls to reduce noise passing through. And that'll change based on the type of noise. Music spaces, for example, are really sensitive at the lower frequencies. So we have specific walls we recommend in those scenarios to allow a music space to exist without sort of incoming thumps maybe from another area. There's also specific walls we like to recommend for HVAC equipment that, again, that's noisy and it's hard to mitigate with a normal wall. We'll recommend floor and ceiling assemblies for people stomping around. We consider this to be structure-borne noise. This is noise that's generated by essentially energizing the structure, and then that vibration will travel through and radiate out of a nearby surface, such as the wall, ceiling, or even floor. You come across that a lot, actually, in recording studios, where if you don't isolate it properly, a lot of times the mics can pick up people walking nearby, even if they're not stomping that hard, and even if it's a carpeted surface. Recording studios are really quiet environments on purpose for the microphones, and the mics just pick up those footfall noises. You might not notice it yourself, or maybe you even do, but the mics certainly notice it. So this is sort of a good image of acoustic separation. Our typical wall is, you know, when we're looking at how we're going to design for this, we need to sort of consider three aspects. One is, what's the noise source? Because someone talking at a normal speaking voice is not the same condition as, say, like an amplified voice. If I'm talking out of a speaker system, that has so much more power than what my voice alone can generate. So a lot of times when we're designing, we can consider for several scenarios, both a normal and raised vocal effort, and then also for rooms that you might have an amplified sound coming out, like a conferencing room of some kind. The second aspect we have to consider is the separating architecture itself. And a lot of times we say separating partition, we mean the wall, but really it's actually sort of the whole complete package. If you have a wall, you generally also have to consider the noise that could possibly go over the wall, through the ceiling, and come down on the other side. Or you would have to run the wall to structure. You also have to worry about architectural joints, and this is where like walls and ceilings and other little bits and bobs, like pipework passing through, sort of come together. This is a good spot for leaks to happen. You could imagine if you were trying to make like a watertight room. It's really hard to do. There's going to be small little spots that someone missed during construction where water is leaking through. So we look for that as well. You also have to take into account sort of the room construction, the interior acoustics of it. How lively a room has an impact on how it sounds, you know, sound passing through. And then there's also stuff that has to do with the receiver. So, you know, how sensitive is the person listening? Some people are really observant and notice a lot when people are speaking on the other side of the wall. Some people don't. It doesn't seem to bother them. The other huge impact is that the background noise in the room. So any sound that's going to pass through an architectural partition of some kind, it comes down to like a signal-to-noise ratio. And if the background noise in the room is higher than the signal, you're not going to notice it. And you run into these scenarios sometimes when they're usually poorly designed conference rooms where the background noise in them is really high, and you don't know it, but the walls are really bad too. But because the background noise is so high from the HVAC system, you're not hearing intruding outside noise. So if you fix the HVAC system, you'll actually hear the people talking all of a sudden randomly, and you run into situations where like confidential conference rooms where they really don't want you to hear what they're talking about inside. So let's see if I can get this to work. So the interior room acoustics is another aspect of the design, and I think this one's maybe this one's like what we're all kind of familiar with, right? You go into a room and you can hear how lively it is. Like, that's generally what we're talking about for most rooms. It has to do with, you know, us selecting wall, ceiling, floor, products to put on those to help determine how what the reverberation time in the room is. Depending on the space, we also like to, we'll do some ray tracing and also like to check to see how the sound is moving around the room. You wouldn't do this for most small rooms. Generally, you can model it pretty easily just by doing the good old-fashioned Sabin calculation and putting some absorption on a wall. That would work pretty well for a room of this size. When you get into large rooms, and actually the lobby in the downstairs of this building is a great example, stuff like ray tracing comes more into the fore. You're really getting some interactions based on where sound is reflecting off of which surfaces. And of course, you get stuff like concert halls where music is important, speech is important, so you really want to shape the direction of the sound in those spaces, of course, right? Or recording studios is another example. So we recommend a lot of stuff for that, but it's also important for like spaces that are not music spaces, right? We do this too for schools, classrooms, conference rooms are critical. You run into scenarios in a classroom where if the room is too lively, a lot of the times the kids can't understand the teacher, and they're not going to say anything about that. They either don't care or they don't think to speak up. So it's really important to make sure classrooms have good acoustics so, you know, students can understand what the teacher is saying. And I also included, just because ray tracing is fun to watch, this is a cat model. I couldn't really figure out where else to put this in the presentation, so I thought I'd just throw it in here if this video works. No. Hold on. Maybe now. No? All right, well, as a backup. Yeah, this is for a school commons that we did pretty recently. We were actually in this scenario more interested at how loud it was going to be in the commons. So this isn't, we don't generally look at a ray tracing for this kind of space, but it was kind of fun to do just to see how it laid out. For something like a theater, we would care much more. But if you look at the model of the room, I can also rotate it.
What's that showing us?
So this is a random source on the floor level that I've set as a person speaking, so roughly 65 dBA. And it's just blasting and waiting for it to basically drop off roughly 30 dBA. So this is like two floors. Yeah, it's fun to watch again. If I rotate this, sort of the long wall here, these large rectangles are windows, and then the wall that's directly across from that is hard to tell, but there's some sections of absorption on there that we modeled so the room would not be too lively. And then it's also, it's sort of two floors, so it's, you get a bit of a, this is sort of a hallway, so you sort of get an interesting interaction of the sound reacting to the second level there.
So that's an impulse that's bouncing around over time?
Yep.
Is it getting louder as time goes by?
No, it's dropping in level. So it starts off...
It's black there for a while.
Yeah, that's lower. That's close to 30 dB.
Oh, right.
It starts off roughly around 65.
Okay, so as the colors change, that's...
louder for a moment before it stops.
Yeah. So, it's fun to watch.
Yeah, that's good.
Design where to place any sound absorbers?
It did. We also used it. The architect didn't want to place any absorption in the room at all. They had a lot of really nice wood surfaces, and a lot of architects actually think that wood is absorptive. They do. It comes up quite often. I get asked that a lot on projects. So they actually thought, at least in the beginning, when the project first started, we recommended that they would need to place absorption on certain surfaces, and we recommended some products. And at some point in between that and the next meeting, the architect had gone away talked it over, found some wood, and had come to the conclusion that the wood itself was absorptive, so we were probably okay. So that model was after we placed the absorption in the room.
So how much did it help?
It helped a bit. So that software is called CAT. We use CAT and Ease out of this office. We use Ease primarily when we're working with like an AV system and we have a speaker, because Ease is a really good software for that. CAT we like because it's kind of nice when you're just doing interior acoustics. I think it's presentation-wise to architects, it's a little friendlier. It looks cleaner than Ease, and they really like that. Presentation to architects we found is really important. We changed the model to include the absorption. It would take me a little bit to change the model back to get rid of the absorption. So I don't have a version of the model where that is not the case. Go ahead.
So these are obviously simulations. Do you go out and verify the simulations? And what kind of error do you get when you do that? What kind of correlation?
That's a great question. We like to when we can. We're not always able to get back into the spaces, depending on the fee for the project budget and stuff like that. But we do try to verify our designs. We particularly like to do that with music classrooms, just because...
Sound check.
Yeah, essentially. That and before all these software... So we found these softwares are more accurate than, like, doing the good old-fashioned Sabin. And I think initially, back when we were just doing Sabin, like, 20 years ago, when these softwares weren't available, we found that our calculations almost never matched up with our... measurements. And I see Ron there looking knowingly.
I can make some comments about Ease. I'm one of the developers of Ease. And I've done probably 2,000 projects and cross-checked about half of them. And if you select your materials based on the absorptive characteristics and not what the name is, then you can get pretty close to probably 75-80% agreement. If you just do it by the name of the product and some of the titles they have, it depends on where you put the materials. If you put the materials at around ear height, you can probably get about 75-80% agreement. But if you put it up at the ceiling, which a lot of people do, or on one wall or on the floor only, the agreement probably is less than 40%.
Is that for ray tracing or just for statistical analysis?
Both. Both. In fact, in most cases, most buildings in the United States will not meet the criteria for the Sabin equation or the Erwin equation.
Yeah.
Okay. But even ray tracing has that problem, and that has to do with the base itself, the material bases and speaker bases.
And also the diffusion characteristics. That can of worms. Never mind. This is a sidebar conversation.
Yeah, we'll go back to definitely talk about that later.
Yeah, it's an interesting question because we do find too sometimes when we go back and take measurements, even our Ease or CAT model don't line up with what we measured. Yeah. So we really like taking the measurements afterwards. Unfortunately, the nature of the beast is you aren't always able to get back in and measure things after you're done. It just depends on how that particular project happens to work out. We generally use Erring when we're calculating, like, just by hand these days, too. We still do that quite a bit. Our clients don't always want us to go ahead and use a computer model. And it for most rooms, it doesn't make sense. If I'm just doing a conference room or a classroom, you know, those are pretty simple rooms. Those have been studied pretty well, and you can generally sort of go with rules of thumb even and come out with a pretty good good room for those. They're still kind of tricky, again, because hard surfaces are, like, really in right now. So architects don't really want to follow those recommendations, but we do our best. Yes, go ahead.
How do people influence the acoustics of a room when you have, like, a church full of people versus no people, or a theater, or, you know?
Oh, yeah. People are pretty absorptive.
Especially in the winter.
Yes. When we're designing our theaters, there's sort of some arguments for theater seating. do you want to go with like hard backs or like absorptive backs? And we actually like to go with absorptive backs. Our design philosophy is that we're trying to have a minimal difference between the theater fully occupied and partially occupied. If you go with the hard backs, cedar seats can provide quite a bit of absorption. So, you know, there's a difference between like a smaller performance and then like, oh, the audience is full.
Yeah, we have a comment we make about churches, and it's more of a joke type thing, but it's actually, it's better than the truth. And that is, if you go to a evangelical church, it usually has more absorption than the Catholic Church does.
Yeah.
And the reason is people are better upholstered.
Yeah.
and they are better low frequency absorbers that way.
No, that sounds great. I grew up Catholic too. Like, that's a good one.
Me too. So. They're more angular, so they have more diffusion.
Yeah, that's right.
Politically correct statement there?
Huh?
Politically correct statement?
I stopped being politically correct when I turned 60 years old. Doesn't matter anymore.
So when we're doing environmental noise things on a project, there's actually sort of two categories for that. There's noise that you'll find on the site. There's actually also noise that the new project itself will generate. And basically, you can think of rooftop HVAC equipment makes noise into the building, makes noise out to the building. So we usually have to look at both. When we're doing an environmental noise study, generally our first thing that we do is open up Google Maps, because Google Maps is great. But at any rate, you would look at a map and sort of identify, you know, nearby noise sources to predict, try and get a rough prediction ahead of time of what you're expecting to find on site. I just grabbed a random location off of Google Maps. My goal was to get an interstate nearby and SeaTac. So at this location, you'd probably get some noise from I-5. It's certainly close enough. Oops, back one. And it's actually really, really right under SeaTac's flight paths right there. When you're looking at essentially airports and planes and things, the noise is quite loud, basically in the directions it takes off and lands, and there's really almost no good way to mitigate that aside from designing the building envelope to address the higher noise levels. With something like an interstate, depending on the surrounding geography and, you know, what your site is like, you can put a barrier in between the building and the interstate. You can't really do that with an airplane. There's no magical floating barrier between that. And actually, in particular, so right around SeaTac, there are a lot of noise code requirements for building exteriors to address the loud noise from airplanes. It's a real issue. And actually, it's kind of gotten worse since 9/11, too, because our military's been authorized. It used to be that there was restricted flight paths. The military was not allowed to just fly wherever they wanted in the country. But since 9/11, they've been authorized. They're in war time. And when they're in war, they're allowed to fly wherever they want. So it's very hard to find a location in the United States, frankly, that is not impacted by airplane noise. I was hiking with some friends in the Enchantments about a month ago, and my friends were shocked at how often we heard airplanes fly overhead. It was probably about once an hour. So, can't get away from humans. This is actually a study of some site noise that's also near SeaTac. This site was, I think it's to the west. It's fairly close to SeaTac, but it's to the west and it's not directly underneath its flight path. We've set up some meters on the site. One of them happened to be near a school. And then we, you know, spent the day sitting out there marking every time an airplane flew overhead. Exciting stuff. So sort of if you look at the dips and the measurement there, we've called out where all the airplanes were. And then we also called out when, like, kids were yelling on the field, because it turns out kids are quite loud. They break noise code all the time, especially schools. We had a really funny project where there's an exception in the noise code for schools where kids are making noise, but one time we did have a project where the city fought us on that. It was recess and the site was too loud. And we were like, well, if you took the kids out of school, you'd meet the noise code. So at any rate, you can see here that this site was not getting directly blasted. There is about a 10 dBA increase in noise whenever an airplane flies overhead, but actually the kids using the field was way noisier than the planes. So noise control. So this one, so there's a whole bunch of things that generate noise in a building that aren't humans. Most of them have to do with the mechanical system. There's also some electrical stuff, like transformers can generate noise if they're large and loud enough. And there's a couple of different pathways, generally, that these will impact people. The most obvious one is stuff that travels down the ductwork. You get a fan, it generates noise, you know, catch a metal tube to it, and noise goes down the tube. So you get noise that comes out that way, and it'll pop out of, like, the diffusers that are serving the room. You also get noise that travels down the ductwork and breaks through the ductwork and radiates down into the space as well. That happens generally when you're really close to a fan. It doesn't tend to happen when you're further away. You might have noticed sometimes when you're near elevator shafts, a lot of ductwork that's close to fans it's located there. And you might hear a loud rumble. That's usually noise coming from ductwork like that. We also get airborne noise from rooftop HVAC equipment, or in mechanical rooms. Sometimes these things are just loud, and if you had an occupied space right next to one, you're going to have to design the wall to be rated high enough to reduce most of the noise from passing through that wall so that no one notices. If we can, we like to recommend that, like, spaces that people don't generally occupy are next to mechanical rooms, like storage or closets or electrical rooms. You also get a noise, again, that's structure-borne. It's vibration that passes through the building, passes from the mechanical equipment into the structure. And that can travel quite some far distances. I was at a project recently where the tenants were complaining about a hum they were hearing. So we went and we looked, and there was no mechanical equipment nearby we could find that was the obvious culprit. And this was like a 50-floor high rise. And the tenant was on, I want to say, like the 15th floor. So eventually, we notice it's turning on and off. And we think that it's related to the elevator. So what we do is the elevator machine room is halfway up the tower in like the 25th floor. So sure enough, 10 floors above, we go and we find out that one of the motors for the elevators is in direct contact with the floor. It wasn't all of them, it was just one motor. So 10 levels below, we were hearing vibration from this equipment. So it can travel quite far, depending on how loud it is and how quiet the space is. I forgot the slide. And then we also have different types of equipment makes different type of noise. So the lower the frequency of the noise, the more difficult it is to mitigate. And the reason for this is because the long wavelengths of lower frequencies generally require larger things to mitigate it. We need a lot of distance and space. Except square footage in buildings is pretty valuable. It's actually kind of hard to find that space sometime. Long before I was doing this, decades ago, it used to be entire floors of buildings reserved just for HVAC equipment, and you'd have hundreds of feet of ductwork before it even got into an occupied space. These days, I have projects where I have maybe 5 feet, and sometimes it's just, there's a really critical space right below. It's really, really common on school projects, for example, for mechanical engineers to put a large fan on the roof where it just drops down immediately into a classroom. And that's hard to control. A lot of times it's a low-frequency rumble from air turbulence, and we have to go far to try and mitigate that noise. So fans and pumps are more low-frequency noise. As you get into smaller fans, so VAV units, it's a small fan in a box, and it usually serves singular rooms.
What does that stand for?
Variable air. I don't know what the second
velocity.
V stands for. Yeah, maybe. They're also referred to as terminal units. Yeah, I need to brush up on that one. So they're just small fans, generally located outside or even above rooms. Chillers, which they show on there, those are a more high-pitched whine. Those are, they're sort of a little self-descriptive. They're what they use to control heat and cooling in a building, so they give you the ability to cool everything down. And then diffusers are, we don't have any in here. It's above the ceiling. All right, they generally look like little square objects with, like, fins coming off of them, and that's what the air comes out of. Or they can be round. They don't have to be square. But any noise, you get, like, fluttering and hissing out of there if the diffusers aren't properly designed for the HVAC system.
It's a good place to do it here. Your low-frequency area. One of the biggest things that we're running into now in the last few years, because we do a lot of research in low-frequency work, is these large power generator systems that are outside the fans. I'm probably getting older, you forget the words.
Yeah.
But they don't turn very fast. But what happens is they institute a rumble, a low-frequency rumble of around 15 to 20 hertz that goes down the stem into the ground because they're supported by large concrete blocks. And they go into the ground, and they radiate for up to 5 kilometers. And they come back up through the foundations of homes and houses and stuff. And then they go into the walls, and the walls actually radiate these low frequencies.
Yeah.
So it's causing some real health problems now with stress and some cases of heart attacks because of the stress.
You're talking about wind turbines?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, there's actually countries now that are starting to pull them out and replacing them with other sources of power because of that. So
you
it's
can
become,
build stuff that you can isolate that.
Well, the problem is in this situation is the turbine itself is embedded in a concrete block, usually the same size. That
yeah,
is,
but if you build it so that you isolate it,
if so far the experience is not the research has shown that not to be the case.
Oh, okay.
There's been a lot of ASA work on that in this area. Now they're starting to have some real problems about trying to figure out whether that's a viable answer to the answer for power now because of that. It causes problems with the animals, causes not to, cows not to get milk. There's all kinds of things now involved here. But especially, you were talking about earlier about psychoacoustics.
Yeah.
This has a large thing because one of the things that was discovered back in the 1930s from Sinting was, have you ever noticed when you go to a movie that has a horror movie like Frankenstein or something like this, you always hear the low-frequency rumble of the music in the background? Well, they discovered back in the 1930s, if you did that just below the level of sound, that it would cause anxiety, and it would make you more nervous about the movie, so you'd be, it's going to happen, it's very uncomfortable. So that's why you hear all these horror movies with this low-frequency stuff going on.
Yeah.
And they find the same thing in real life, that a lot of low frequencies cause anxiety and make you stress out. So it raises blood pressure and all kinds of other things.
Yeah, I've heard, what is it, they think a lot of, like, supernatural or haunted houses that people experience for, they find sometimes, like, low-frequency generating sources, which are below our range of hearing.
Yeah.
But we can feel it on some level, and they think that might be behind.
That's really our biggest area of problem right now in research is low-frequency work.
Yeah. Noise in general is like a big, there's been a lot of research in the last couple decades that have come out. It could be like a real health concern. Cities keep getting noisier and seems to be related to cardiovascular disease in both humans and other animals. So I suspect that, and we give a lot of attention to it now, but environmental noise in particular, we haven't really thought about it that much yet. And I suspect in the next couple decades, there's going to be a lot of focus in that area to see if it's possible to reduce what we can. A lot of the things we do, though, generate quite a bit of noise, so it's going to require some thought on our end.
So you're saying like below 20 hertz? Or
It usually is below 20 hertz. Usually infrasonic, usually between 5 and 15 hertz.
There's an invention by Audio Control called Epicenter that purposely generates low frequencies by putting them in a nonlinear mixer and then shunting the area, basically shifting the frequencies down to.
There was a project in the military back in the 1950s for a way of killing people bloodlessly. And it, they had a driver that was about 35 feet in diameter, and it ran at 6.5 hertz. And it was the right frequency where it caused the membranes between the cells to rub against each other and liquefy.
Oh.
Caused the cells to disintegrate.
Yeah.
And basically die. And they turned it on, and military intelligence is an oxymoron here, turned it on, gave the guys earmuffs. And it was hooked up directly to a large power source of multi-megawatts. And they had to send a robot in to turn it off and basically destroy the piece of equipment because it couldn't be used.
Yeah.
But basically, the two guys were running liquefied, melted down, dead.
Yeah.
So it's low frequencies can hurt you.
Yeah.
That's the best way I can put it to you.
There's no friend or foe for that.
Huh?
That affects everybody. It doesn't affect just...
Yeah,
the
well, that's,
oh, yeah.
That was the point about military intelligence.
Well, that's the idea behind this, the rap music for your people in their cars. They use that epicenter. So when they drive by, they'll...
Well, I always think that if you have a low-frequency driver heading down, you probably make the car float on a cushion of air. Go down the road.
That may explain why the youth are so unruly. Potentially.
What frequency is this fan noise that we're hearing here?
Oh, geez. Probably around 125. Yeah, good catch. I was actually going to bring it up. There are a couple of, we call them pancake units, located throughout the building. An acoustical consultant, I think, was not involved on the initial shelling core design of this building. We knew because we actually got called in for one of the other floors, the first people to occupy this building. They're like, oh, yeah, because there was, I think in the lease originally, there was like a design criteria for it will be this level of background noise. And they're like, oh, no one's checked. So they hired us to check. And, oh, God, it was something terrible. It was like 85 dBA or something.
That's like the ocean level.
Yeah, well, it was mostly being driven, so this tone that you hear here, it was mostly being driven by that. The rest of the unit wasn't that bad, but, like, you were getting, like, these 80 dB tones. So it wasn't great. It was a lot worse on the lower levels. So, because they'd already sort of finished the tenant improvement project, so they already had a lot of the interior treatments complete. So they're calling us in at this point, too. So we're like, oh, no, you need to go back and, like, do all these things, which involve cutting into the ceiling. And even then, it's not ideal, right? Because you can still hear it.
It's out of the speech range, which is nice.
It is. A lot of units seem to have tones these days. It's related to the number of the blades on the fans. And we try to do our best to stop it. But
this is?
Sorry?
You know what brand of HVAC that
is? I actually don't. I should look it up.
He's very surprised if you did. But it could be a feature because in the building that we occupy, they pump pink noise in. They say it's good for masking the office noise.
Yeah.
So it's supposed to help our concentration.
Yeah. So it'll suppress your external noise sources. So if you bump up your noise level, then the perceived level of talking over the wall is less, or people tend to whisper.
We have that in our office, too.
Okay.
The best way I've come up with to describe it, again, I came up with this for architects. If you imagine a pitch black room, and every person speaking in is a candle, the candles are really going to stand out. But let's pretend that the overhead lights are background noise from an HVAC system or an electronic masking system. You turn them on, the candles haven't changed. You can still see them, and you're probably going to notice the ones who are really close to you. You might not notice the ones that are on the other side of the room. In fact, you probably won't. So it's all relative.
Good analogy.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's good.
Yeah, the delta.
Yep, exactly. So the last sort of aspect of noise control is vibration control. And again, this is structure-borne noise that comes from operation of fans or chillers or pumps or other equipment. There's a couple different ways of isolating them. I've shown only one here. This is a spring isolation system. Other ways of isolating them are on like neoprene pads, which is just a type of rubber of some flavor. Or you can also isolate it on airbags, too, depending. That's kind of expensive, so that doesn't happen as often.
An earlier slide that you showed that had the subway down in the basement had a shape kind of like this in the pillars that were going down into the earth. Was that what that was showing?
Which one?
More there. Down at the very bottom, next to the subway.
Yeah.
That kind of shape. Is that saying the building is suspended somehow?
No, that's supposed to show below the earth, I think, although they haven't really done a good job with that. That's supposed to show vibration energy that's traveling up through the building structure.
But the little shape in the middle of those four columns.
Oh, yeah. No, that could be, actually, vibration isolation.
Huh. Okay.
Because the vibration stops when it hits that. Yeah. So maybe it is vibration isolation.
Yeah, yeah.
That's... I haven't seen many buildings on springs.
No, but depending on the building, yeah, no, there's been some jacked up spring buildings. There's also been, you're more likely to see, like,
recording studios.
Yeah.
But regular buildings.
Yeah, we do that for recording studios a lot. We'll have, like, a floating isolated floor.
They're using spring low the place now for earth control.
They are.
Okay. Same thing.
They're also...
So both Boeing and Microsoft's data centers around here, you can go in and some of them are in liquid bearing, but most of them are at least spring, because it keeps the hard drives from minor tremors that we wouldn't feel.
Yeah.
Skip your data all over the place. So I toured Boeing's in Bellevue years ago, and they said they wouldn't have an error at less than like a 5.6 earthquake. The building would just sit there and float enough, but it had multiple types of dampings to deal with large earthquake events, but also just freeway noise, which was near it, was one of the problems. And other things. But the whole building around the edge had this this gap, the same way we do home theaters with isolated floors.
They'll also use they'll use Silomer isolators too. That's another type of rubber, essentially. They'll just fill the whole bottom of the foundation and the sides with this rubber, essentially, and then build every pour in concrete and build on top of that, kind of.
I mean, our laboratory's in. Nuclear reactor.
Yeah, that's isolated, right?
It was designed for a magnitude 10 earthquake on springs and a 10 megaton nuclear bomb on its roof.
Yeah.
Okay. So we're not too worried about noise getting inside anymore.
Yeah.
We've got a ditch around the building that's 6 inches wide that goes down 1,000 feet.
Yeah, wow.
Okay. And so it's like, every kind of vibration control you can imagine is.
Yeah.
Along with 20 feet of concrete in the walls.
Right. The ultimate in noise control.
You can't build your laboratory on a mountain, you bring the mountain to the building.
Yeah, there you go.
I was looking up some hard drives, and the server hard drives have vibration sensors on them. And so if you put them in an array, they can actually kind of work with each other. I thought that was pretty interesting. You're paying attention, so as you mentioned, if vibrations came through, it wouldn't corrupt your data because they're just microns away, those moving heads on the platters.
That's pretty neat.
Yeah, it's pretty cool.
Thank you.
All right. So I've gone over sort of just the basic overview of architectural acoustics. I'm actually going to take a step back and go over how buildings are designed, period, because I think it's not a I didn't know the process before I started doing this, so I wouldn't expect... It's not always necessarily intuitive. So buildings sort of are designed in almost two phases. You have the design phase and the construction phase. So basically what happens when you're going to go into a construction... the client, we call them the end users, will decide, I'm going to build a 20-story elementary school. I want that. So they're going to go out with like a description of the project, and they're going to try and find an architect. So architects will bid on that, and the client will select an architect. And then basically the architect is going to meet with the client at that point, get like a description of what the client wants, what the client thinks they need, what their budget is, what their long-term plans and expectations are. And this is essentially called pre-design, or we're not usually brought in at this stage. So the architect will do all of these interviews, and then we'll move into something called schematic design. And this is the point where the architect starts to hire consultants. They'll on almost every project, you're going to have a mechanical engineer, an electrical engineer, a structural engineer. Those are all really important to the project. But they'll also bring in, like, acoustical consultants at that stage. Depending on what your project is, say if you're working on an auditorium, they'll have, like, theater consultants. There's lighting consultants. There's a... I don't work with them that often, but landscape architects and all this geo engineering and all sorts of stuff like that. So we get brought on at the schematics design stage, or sometimes design development and construction documents. And when this is happening, at this point, they're starting to narrow the program a little bit. They're going to come up with a square footage and an idea of where the rooms will be located and what rooms the project will have. And once that's done, we move from schematic design to design development, and that's when we actually design the whole thing. We run calculations. We look at what their needs are. We try to come up with how everything's going to be laid out. And then construction documents is when you... we're already documenting this as we go through, but the idea with construction documents is you're putting everything down onto plans or specifications that a contractor can then look at and then work off of to build the building the way that you designed it. Once all this is complete, we move into the construction phase, and that's split into two parts. The bidding phase, which is really short. The contractors will bid on the project. They'll go through the project documents that you just designed, and they'll put down an estimate for how much they think it's going to take to build the thing. And then the client will select the contractor based on those bids, and they'll move ahead with that, and we'll move on into construction administration when they start buying the products to build the building and start building it, of course. It's on a side note, if it's a government project where tax funds are being used, they are required to go with the lowest bidder. So if you ever wonder why something like schools or certain types of housing seem like they're low quality, maybe you shouldn't be going with the lowest bidder, but they are required to by law, so there's no way out of that.
Value engineering.
Yeah.
Which is neither.
Yeah. Almost generally, you never want to go with the lowest bidder. Never. They get selected most of the time, unfortunately. Yeah. Even for non-government projects. Recently, I think in the last 10 or so years, they've been doing sort of a new style called GCCM. And that's in that style, the contractor is actually brought on early, say in like schematic design. And the idea for this is that once you, in a more typical project, when you complete the design, when the contractors bid, they're providing with you what they expect the costs are going to be. The idea was that if you brought the contractor on earlier, they could do cost estimates periodically throughout the design. And that way you'd find out if, you know, you're on budget or not. I'm not sure it's made an overall difference in costs, but it's pretty popular right now, so a lot of times that happens. So bidding doesn't really happen when you're doing that type of project. The construction administration still happens. So basically what the acoustic consultant does in this scenario is during schematic design, we work with the client to establish a project criteria. A lot of the times, the client has a rough idea of what they want, but they don't know how to describe it. And particularly for non-music spaces, musicians and recording engineers know what they want. For a lot of other building types, the clients don't. They never even thought about acoustics. And if they did, it's usually because something went horribly wrong on their building before. Like, the previous space had, like, terrible conference rooms, like, you know, there were holes in the walls, there's other problems too, the HVAC was too loud, and they don't want to deal with it again. They also tend not to know what to look for acoustically when we're designing. So we work with the client to help establish that, you know, how loud is the background noise going to be? What kind of performance do you need out of your walls? What kind of room response are you looking for? Is speech intelligibility important for you? Or, you know, maybe you're in a small private office, and it's not that speech intelligibility is not important, But usually you won't have more than one or maybe two people talking at once. So we don't need to worry about wall panels because they're not engaging the walls that much, relatively speaking. From there, we gather other project information from both the architects and other consultants as relevant to the project. We work a lot with mechanical engineers, sometimes with electrical if we find that they're going to be putting transformers or other things near noise-critical spaces. We work with structural sometimes. A lot of our recommendations will impact the structural engineer. From there, we come up with sort of a preliminary analysis and recommendations. And from there, it's mostly coordination with the other disciplines to make sure our recommendations are implemented. We're kind of unique from other engineers. A lot of them produce drawings. We do not. We might produce a little bit of drawings, but we're not like the architects where we go through and draw every room down to the last detail. We don't typically do that. We help provide project documentation by maybe like detailing how this one little wall joint is going to look. It might seem little, but it's really important. Otherwise, the whole design will fail at this one location. We also help provide specifications where it's important. Once we move into construction, we help review submittals from the contractor. And submittals are basically just the contractor saying, hey, I bought this product. Does this work? And we say,
I'm going to buy this product.
Yeah, I'm going. Sometimes they already have, and we get the...
But then you can tell them, disapprove the submittal, and
I can. And, yeah, that can be tricky, too, though. Yes, I've also had projects where the contractor held the schedule hostage. The client needed to move in at a specific time. They avoided showing us the product for as long as possible. We told them no. They said, well, oops, it's too late now. You'll have to wait another 6 months. And the client's like, oh, we can't wait six
liquidated
months.
Damages?
Yeah. So we do that. We also visit during construction just to make sure that the design is being followed, particularly for tricky elements with walls. A lot can go wrong with walls and joints. That shows up quite a bit. Oh, okay. So next I was going to move into case studies. I know we typically take a break. Is now a good time for that?
8:30. Kind of a little early.
Yeah?
Yeah. Another half hour?
Yeah.
Does that work?
Yeah, I think so. I think I have another half hour of material, so maybe I'm a little short, but... Okay. Yeah. So I'm going to go over a couple of projects that we worked on. And I'm going to try and emphasize different parts of acoustic design with these different projects. But the first one is a hospital project I worked on. So typically when you're working on hospitals, interior room acoustics is important, but it's not as important as controlling the overall noise in a hospital. And this relates to both the mechanical system, but also like people talking. So the separating architecture becomes really important here. You want to be able to give patients speech privacy, especially when bad news is involved, which unfortunately does happen in hospitals. There's HIPAA, of course, you have to worry about, so you also don't want anyone to overhear their private medical information. We often design this to work in conjunction with background noise from the mechanical system. A lot of times when we're deciding on separating architecture, we're also considering on how loud the background noise is and what intruding noise through a wall might sound like on the other side. The other thing you want to do is you want a minimal room response in hospitals. Just because, patients who are hard of hearing, you want them to be able to understand their doctor quite easily. Hospitals are kind of noisy. There's a lot of machines there that make a lot of noise. So ideally, you would like to sort of reduce room reflections to address that. Generally, there's not a lot of places you can put absorption in a hospital. You basically get the ceiling, and that's about it. The furniture will absorb some noise in the room, but you can't really have carpeted floors, oftentimes for infection control purposes. That's definitely important. And then a lot of the times, most of the walls are being used for medical devices. So you're not going to put anything on the walls. And then not to mention, again, most acoustical products you could put on the walls you'd probably run into an infection control problem. Again, you don't want anything to absorb viruses or germs. So on this project was particularly interesting because we were working on a new type of partition system. The systems are operable and, no, sorry, modular. And generally when you think of that, you think of being able to take a partition and move it locations. We work with, there's a couple of different modular partition companies, and generally they're really popular because they're cheap. Put up the walls, take them down, and move them someplace else if you decide you're going to rearrange your office a couple of years from now. In the hospital, they're not so much interested in that. They're interested in being able to change out medical devices as needed. So in a typical hospital environment, if you were to go and needed new medical technology in the walls, what would happen is you'd have to close down an entire wing to operate, to change out one room, if that's what you wanted to do. The reason for this is dust, sheetrock dust from taking things in and out of the walls. And they can move quickly, but this is going to take a lot of time, and that's a lot of beds that are not available. So this was, we worked with these modular partitions to, no sheetrock was involved. They had these little square panels that you could take out, put in your new medical device, switch it in, move some things around, put in a dialysis box if you wanted to. They had that. So we were going to do this. So we had to do extensive testing because hospitals, or at least in Washington State, hospitals have extensive noise code requirements and design requirements to make sure that the walls are performing to spec. So we had to test these walls to make sure they worked. The other thing we were going for is in the hospital, there is a lot of HVAC and piping that was moving overhead of the rooms. So ideally, you wanted the walls to stop before it reached the structure. It's just easier to put all that equipment in otherwise. So the issue with this, though, is that once you do this, because the wall doesn't go all the way, there's a noise path now, right? There's noise that goes through the ceiling, over the wall, down into the room below. So you also have to take into account the ceiling tile. So what we did to make sure this wall worked was, one, we came up with a really, really bulky wall, like roughly like an STC 60-something construction from this manufacturer. The reason for this is because the total performance of the separating architecture is going to be the performance of the wall plus the performance of the ceiling tile. And usually the ceiling tile is the weak link, and it's going to bring everything down. But if you can get a strong performing wall, you are starting at like a stronger position. So you only need the ceiling tile to perform as best as you can get. So we came up with a couple scenarios. One, we had the wall stopping just underneath the ceiling. We sealed it to that. And then one extends above the ceiling, and we played around with openings. This is the wall that was used on the project. So to explain it, you had like a couple of layers of MDF panels, medium density fiberboard, and then we had these two layers of, in the middle, we called it our MGO sandwich. MGO stands for magnesium oxide board. This really dense material. We had some absorption in the middle there, and then some more MDF. And I think when it was lab tested again, it came out to like STC 60 something. So we had a good strong starting point. We were aiming to get to like STC 45 because that was the requirements, and we were going to have high enough background noise to make sure the patients would have speech privacy. This is what it looked like built. You can see some of the medical devices in there. That's actually quite a large panel. You could probably fit a lot of medical devices in there. And then this is what it looked like above the ceiling. We played around with removing these panels to see how much we could get open. And we ultimately found that we could remove about half of them and put HVAC equipment running through there and still meet the requirements. We also did we have all of these numbers to describe how something forms acoustically, right? But we almost always try to do subjective testing, too. The reason for this is because it doesn't, the numbers do not always line up exactly. with what people hear. And then, of course, everyone also hears differently, right? We each have our own different way of listening. So we also ran around, like, yelling and reading random literature to see if these walls worked too. And it came out as a success. I think when people were yelling, you might notice them a little bit, but not really. Oh, yeah, go ahead.
Maybe two slides back, you showed the two alternatives. So I didn't quite grasp the process. You said you had to decide between whether the wall ends at the small or
not. Yeah, we did.
Did you build out tests? Did you numerically? Or
we built all three of these rooms.
Oh.
What we did is we put a speaker in the center room. We ran some white noise. We measured in the room. Then we measured on the other side of both of these walls, and then we subtracted the difference to roughly get the performance of the separating architecture. So we did this over a period of like 3 days, just moving panels, changing little features, changing out the ceiling tile, trying all these different things to try and come up with something that worked.
So you have a large, like,
there's a whole new meeting to breadboard.
We did, yeah. Yeah, we love to mock up things if we can. Again, as Ron was mentioning, sometimes modeling it doesn't always come out accurate. And we found if we can build a mock-up of that specific situation, it's great to test scenarios and see how it's going to work. Not only that, you can bring the client in into the mock-up and say, this is what your room is kind of going to look like. Do you like how this sounds? And they get to make a decision on the spot.
Even in the testing mode that we're in, where we test built things like this in our TL openings and stuff, you know, we actually have had to bring in whole sections of airplanes
to
test for crew quarters and stuff like that, where they bring in an entire crew quarters section, and then we have to put the sign on the outside, measure on the inside, figure out how to stuff sound. So, you know, that's why we have 140 dB of sound source.
Yeah.
Be able to do that kind of stuff.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, go ahead.
Do you have a space where you can mock these things up, or do you have to go on site?
It depends on what it is.
Like these wall structures.
Oftentimes, we try to build it on site if we can. Sometimes that's not available to us, especially if the building doesn't exist yet.
Yeah.
So we'll find a similar site and build it there instead.
Is there any requirements for dampening out the agonizing screams of the patients?
No.
Negative.
No, I think they train the nurses, though, to, like, take and, like, you know.
Muffle them?
Yeah, muffle them while they're.
Keep the spare pillow on hand.
Yeah.
You were mentioning that having some bit of background noise could actually be beneficial, and I think that came up earlier, and I was wondering if maybe you could talk a little more about that.
Yeah. So, The best example I can think of actually goes to comparing it to a recording studio. So recording studios are really quiet. And if I were to build sort of a regular wall, but kept out quiet, the recording studio it is, it would sound terrible. You'd hear everything really easily. A typical wall reduces roughly 40 decibels of human speech. And the background noise in a recording studio is roughly 15 decibels. So if I were to take a human speaking voice, which is 65 decibels, subtract 40, that puts me at 25 decibels. That's still 10 dB louder than the background noise of the recording studio. Now, if I were to take the recording studio and increase the background noise, which you wouldn't want to do because you needed to be quiet for the mics, about by the time I get to 35 decibels, which is perceived as twice as loud by humans, then the 25 decibels, you wouldn't really hear me speaking anymore. The mics probably wouldn't hear me speaking anymore. It'd be picking up the background noise from the HVAC system.
I see. So it's increasing the background noise in the room to reduce its ratio to the
transmitted. Yeah.
This is why we call them sound.
An example that we used to use for that kind of situation is a bathtub. Okay, if you have a bathtub, you have a 1-inch input and a 2-inch drain, the tub will drain constantly, okay? But if you swap that out and you have a 2-inch input instead of 1-inch output, the tub will eventually fill to a certain level, period, just because it doesn't get rid of the water fast enough. So it'll level out at a certain point and the pressure will increase where it'll stay at one spot. if you increase the level of noise or sound or water, it will go to a different point and it will still level out. The point is, if you're laying down in that tub and you happen to be down and it's just really close to where the water's right here as you're laying down, as long as your nose is above the water, okay, or above the air, you can hear the difference or you can breathe. But as soon as you go underwater, it doesn't matter how far underwater you are, you're easily drowned. Okay, so it doesn't matter what the background noise is when you're below above a certain point. You're not going to notice it because you're it's gone at that point.
Yeah, you drowned it.
Thanks for unpacking that for me.
Yeah. All right, so I'm going to move on to a music type of venue. So auditoriums. So auditoriums, there are a wide variety of those types. Oftentimes when we're working on an auditorium project, the first thing we do is go to the client and say, what do you want to use your auditorium for? The reason for this is that different types of activities in the auditorium, whether, say, it's speech or amplified music or perhaps maybe more classical orchestra, sound better in different reverberant environments. And I think roughly you could look at it as you want a relatively low reverberation time in rooms that are for speech relative to the volume compared to, and then the maximum you would ever want is sort of an organ. A pipe organ sounds great in really reverberant spaces. That's why it's really fun to go into those old cathedrals with like a great pipe organ. They sound fantastic in those spaces. But you'd never want to, you don't want to use those for speech. In fact, actually, I suspect that the reason why they used to sing the Catholic Mass for centuries was because the cathedrals they were building had really long reverberation times. And it was a way that the congregants could actually understand what the priests were saying. If you speak in a church, that's a lot harder. That's why a lot of old cathedrals have retrofitted now that they don't sing anymore and added in speaker systems to help improve speech intelligibility. So there's a bunch of different styles. Generally, the older the style of the music, the better it does in a reverberant environment. So like earlier forms of classical music do really well. As you get into more modern styles of music, especially amplified music or musical theater, that changes. Intelligibility becomes important. And then amplified music, you sort of get the additional factor of it can just be really darn loud.
That would explain those Gregorian chants just drone on.
Yeah.
Oh, Domine.
No, they go for a long time. I think one of the most fascinating parts of going into acoustics was my first degree was a music degree. So you take all these musical history classes, and the Catholic Church had a long tradition of music and influenced a lot of classical music. So you spend a lot of time learning about it and how they used to sing all of the parts and the traditional way of singing them. And then it was really funny to go into acoustics and find like, oh, yeah, speech intelligibility, it's an issue. And all the churches, they were going for grand, tall, lots of glass for light to come through, like hard surfaces, because they thought it was holy. But that leads to really long reverberation times. So I suppose it's just, you know, it made sense for them to sing everything so people could understand it.
Yeah, one of the things that's happened during that period of time was I did a paper on this, the liturgy and the changing, was the locations of the pulpits.
Yeah.
They moved depending on how big the room was, how reverberant it was, and the singing of the Gregorian chant came during that period, because what happened was the original pulpit was in the center, and during the Roman style of the church, where you still hear things. But what happened was you started increasing the volume without increasing the seating capacity, without the area capacity, so you got more reverberation. So in order to be able to be heard, they had to put pulpits on both sides so the priest could go from one side, speak, they can be heard on this side, but not on that side. And they'd take the whole thing over, go to the other side, and say the same thing on this side.
Yeah.
And they started singing it at that point in time. Now, later on, they changed the church back again, so you go to a center, but they didn't want to do that. The tradition says now we have two pulpits. So they raised one and basically made that the holy pulpit, and the other one was the lower one for things. So they kept the two, in spite of the fact they could speak from either one quite well. That's how we ended up two pulpits.
Yeah. So there's several aspects to good auditorium or theater design, right? You want the room to have clarity so that people can understand the music. A lot of music has lyrics. That's important. You also want definition so they can hear changes in dynamics and different, and that also helps with lyrics as well. You want the reverberant response of the room to be long enough that music sounds good in it. It's hard to play music in a dead room. I speak this from experience, especially on the violin. The violin is a really hard instrument to fight a dead room with. You want the space to give a listener a really good impression of it, particularly room volume. You want them to have like sort of a good mental image, even without listening, or sorry, looking to see. They should be able to hear that. You also want a nice sense of envelopment. Sounds like the music is coming from all sides, that you're sort of in the middle of it. And then you also want it to be loud enough and sort of as evenly spread as you can get. You don't want it to be like blasting the audience in the front, but you don't want the audience underneath the balcony too to have a poor listening experience. So to do this in these types of spaces, we look at a couple of different things. Most of it is comparing sort of reflections off the side and ceiling, or the cheek walls and the ceiling, to sort of the direct sound. And there's several different acoustic metrics that have developed for concert halls over the years that, you know, has different like energy ratios of these reflections to the direct sound. We also look for that the stage is providing adequate support for the musicians. For theater purposes, it's often really good to have sort of a good tall space so they can work with sets and lighting and all that stuff. That's not necessarily great for musicians. You want overhead reflectors to help support them so that they can hear themselves and also that other person sitting on the opposite side of the stage. I mean, granted, they should be watching the conductor also and the other members of the ensemble, but it's much easier when you can hear who you're playing with. Yeah. Ooh. When I was in music school, we had this fun exercise in string quartets to get us to practice listening to each other, where we would go into a large room and sit with our backs turned to each other, like roughly 20 or 30 feet from each other. It was really hard to, you had to listen really close. Ooh, that's not really readable, is it?
No.
All right, well, okay. So I'll give, yeah. So I'll go over some of these. So reverberation time, I think a lot of people are familiar with that one. That's the how long it takes for sound to decay in a room, about 60 seconds or so. In a performance hall, you want the room to have a sense of liveliness, and then of course, depending on the style of music, you want the liveliness to be a certain amount of time.
I think you meant 60 dB.
Yeah, 60 dB.
How much? Oh,
I said 60 seconds.
Ooh, 60 seconds. You're right. Sorry, 60 dB. Ooh, yeah, 60 second reverberation time. That would be impressive. Yeah, no, it would be. Although it sounds like that would be possibly a fun music composition piece to come up with.
Gregorian chants.
Yeah, there you go.
Somebody was recording in the old concrete fuel reservoirs in one of the military bases.
Yeah.
There was giant concrete, like 100 feet across and 20 feet tall, and they had a reverb time of RT60 of like 25 seconds or something.
Yeah.
That's the cistern.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's
a
2 billion gallon water tank that nothing's in it, and it's 40 seconds.
RT60 40 seconds.
I did an album in there, and it was so cool. Well, we impulsed it too. So I ran tone sweeps and got, you know, convolution array and an 8-channel array. And the arc was like 75 feet, so it's massive. Like you can feel the room because there's enough data coming back at you. But yeah, we would play the test tone back this week just to get levels, and then you hit stop. And you're like, I hit stop, didn't I? Because
yeah.
The difference between the room generating wasn't doing this, you know, fall off. It was just bang, just kept going, and it's stupid loud too. So.
Yeah.
Our laboratory, our free field facility, has an RT 60 in 48 seconds.
Wow.
But the building is 700 feet long, 300 feet wide, and 80 feet high.
And you'd really have to energize the room to get that, I'm sure.
And then our the other one we have, I think, Rick, you were there in the tower. Where you have
the cooling
rotating
tower.
Reflection.
Yes.
Cooling tower inside. So it rotates this way and rotates this way. At the same time, it lasts for roughly 25 to 30 impulses.
So if you clap your hand, the sound goes around.
Yeah, it goes
that's
around
fun.
This way and this way.
Yeah. There's audio on our website from that.
Yeah. And it's about 30. It's about 35 to 40 seconds of individual impulses for one point. Really interesting. A lot of recording people will love to get that.
Yeah. No, it's kind of fun. Actually, I have to admit, I have a certain soft spot for so-called acoustic defects. One of my favorites are flutter echoes.
Oh, yeah. Oh,
they're just fun. If you go into a performance space and you get, I mean, you don't want it in certain locations, but we've gone on sites where we're trying to address a flutter echo, and we've just stood there and clapped our hands and did stuff.
Especially when you get flutter echo that gives you comb filtering on top of it. That is a really cool sound.
Yeah, it's entertaining. Well, and the funny thing is, too, actually, you do get flutter echo in a lot of different auditoria just because the shoebox shape is quite popular. And usually when we're speaking to clients that are renovating those projects, they'll be like, oh, yeah, we really like that. But if I go into the audience and just do this, like, I get a flutter echo.
Yeah.
Can you fix that?
Yeah.
And, like, yeah, we technically could, but you're not performing in the space like that,
right.
So... You know, if there's people in the audience, you would hope all of them are clapping, not like one person doing it ironically.
Have you been or heard about the Frank Lloyd Wright School of Architecture Performance Hall in Arizona?
No, I haven't.
None of the walls face each other. It expands from the rear to the front. And
oh, yeah.
It's a hexagon, so even the walls don't face each other.
Yeah. There's a concert halls are interesting because there's a couple of different common shapes that you see. The shoebox shape is the sort of long-standing, traditional, popular, does a good job, gets the job done. Fan shapes are popular. There's a couple of sort of vaguely diamond-like shapes. And then I feel like you get into like the Frank Lloyd Wright style or other styles where they, you know, go into real detail and model where the sound is going to hit at what point in the room and shape everything just right. I'm trying to remember that new concert hall. I want to say it's in Europe somewhere where they used algorithms to shape every surface in the room. And it's this gorgeous looking project.
They remodeled the Berlin Philharmonic that way. And it's really interesting looking.
Yeah. I've seen them perform there, and it's definitely one of my favorite halls.
Yeah.
It's such a gorgeous sounding hall. The one that I'm ashamed to say that I still haven't visited yet is the Boston Symphony Hall, which is a shoebox style hall, and of course it's supposed to be one of the top three halls in the world. The other two are in Europe. So
Concerto Gebouw.
Huh?
Concerto Gebouw.
Yeah.
In Amsterdam.
Yeah. So someday I'll go and visit there. I lived much closer to it when I was on the East Coast.
What's the third one in Europe? What's the other one in Europe?
I'm sad to say that I don't have their names memorized because they're German or Dutch generally. after reverberation time, we look at clarity. So this is a ratio to early to late energy. And what's considered early is the energy that arrives before 80 milliseconds, late is after. And generally, you're looking for positive. It's reported in decibels. What is it? I think it's positive values are it's better clarity, and I think the ratio is higher early energy. But generally, you're looking for this, you know, just to You're looking for higher clarity values for music with speech as a part of it, and it's not as big of a concern for orchestral music.
So the divisions are 0 to 2 for organ music.
Yeah.
2 to 4 for classical music. Things like modern style church music, and then 4 to 6, 6 and above for rock and roll and stuff like that. So
yeah.
Looking at the case of violin, yes, stroked, plucked,
yeah,
or percussion, and that's where it comes out. So it's equivalent to the intelligibility measurement of speech.
Yeah.
But it's the intelligibility of music.
Yeah.
So you can define a run rather than a glissando.
Yeah. Spot on. Definition, which is, it's also sort of, this is the early energy to the total energy, not counting the direct sound. And it's up to 50 milliseconds here. And then center time, it's another measure for clarity. And it's, again, a comparison of early and late reverberant energy. There's a lot of ratios here.
Are these the ones from Ease? Or
no, these are...
General.
These are general. These concert...
3382.
Yeah. Concert halls have been really well studied over the decades. Acousticians really like them for some reason. So they put a lot of time and effort to try and come up with these essentially hard number metrics to describe concert halls and how well they perform and why people like them.
Yeah. And there's a lot of minor breakdowns, like the clarity one. There's C80, which is the one she's talking about for music. There's
yeah.
also C50 and yeah. C7 as well. And C50 was the very first measurement of intelligibility. And C7 was for location of sources. And those were all determined by, if you're familiar with these, Wolfgang Arndt did his PhD papers on those.
What's the most I've read a lot of the acoustical papers, but there are, menu choices in Ease, so I think,
It seems like concert hall acoustics is really the dark art.
Yeah.
There's so
yeah.
many that have been designed with all of these ideas, and they sound terrible.
Yeah.
And that was even the scary thing when I was living in Massachusetts. They wanted to redo Boston Symphony Hall, and there's
no.
like this tremendous uproar.
About
it's like,
that.
No, you can't touch it, you can't touch it, you can't touch it. And I think they ended up having to do some repairs on it, but it was because the repairs were difficult because it had been done. What makes that shoebox so good is all the incredible plaster ornamentation
yeah.
that produces this diffusion.
Right? Yep.
And there's no way to duplicate that. I mean, because they were all very elaborate, done by Italian artisans, so it's like it was a lot of work to rework everything, re-plaster it and everything
yeah.
else. But it's a good thing they didn't touch it, because that's, I think, the yeah. secret. And I did have an opportunity once to sit in one of the upper second balcony, but above the stage, and it was a performance by Oregon, and there was this piece. They started playing the organ, not the pipe organ, which is on stage. And I was just sitting there, and I was listening to the ceiling because this fantastic shower of sound was coming down from the ceiling. It's a big
yeah.
diffusion of it. It's just incredible.
Yeah. Boston Symphony Hall is also kind of interesting because it's technically the first hall where they used ray tracing to figure out where the sound was going. Of course, they didn't have computer software at the time, so they literally just took a light and a mirror and stood in different points in the hall.
Dr.
Yeah, to figure out where the sound was going. So another good metric is the interaural cross-correlation coefficient, which is a mouthful to say. I think we usually just call it IACC. Basically, you need a special microphone to measure it. We have a dummy. We call him Buster. He has microphones in both of his ears. That's what we use to measure halls. You're just comparing the amount of acoustic energy that arrives at both ears and how similar they are. It's a good sort of acoustic metric for envelopment. And you can think of it roughly as this. If the sound arrives roughly and is mostly at the same time in both ears, you're probably getting reflections from like the same location. you're not getting reflections from multiple parts in the hall, which is what you want for a good feeling of envelopment. And then, I did not include warmth on here, apparently, so I'm going to describe warmth, another popular metric. Generally, in music spaces, you want a decent low-frequency response. It's supportive. It gives, like, a nice underbelly. The best way I can think of it is you wouldn't want to listen to a piccolo all the time.
So you're talking about reverb time so that it has, you know, normally it's biased towards low frequencies because,
yeah,
you know, first order reflections have higher frequency components, but reverb tends to have, they get diffused and absorbed.
And this is also a ratio of reverberant energy. This is a ratio of reverberant energy at the low frequencies compared to reverberant energy at the middle frequencies. And then we also have, especially speech intelligibility metrics, because of course not all performance venues are designed exclusively for music. You have theater, musical theater, and you're going to want to be able to understand. So we primarily have two different types of speech metrics. We have the speech transmission index, which is STI. We often use it to measure also the audio system in the theaters too. But it's basically sort of a machine measure of speech intelligibility based on how much the signal has changed and degraded from the source to the receiver. So you generally want higher values. It's on a scale of 0 to 1. And the closer you are to 1, the more intelligible the sound is in the room. We also have a percent articulation loss of consonants, which we call percent alcons, because that's easier. And this one is the number of syllables out of 100 that are not intelligible. So, yeah, this is also a machine metric.
Well, it used to be somebody would be reading all these words.
Yeah.
Somebody would be marking down which ones they could understand.
It's a lot easier. We've done that subjectively, too, and... Man, it must have been a lot of work before.
Well, there was a set of CDs you could buy. That had a single monosyllable voice that would say, please write the word go. Please write the word Joe. Please write the word, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
Okay? And you would have 40, 50 people out in the audience, and they'll be writing this stuff down. It would take 2 or 3 hours to do it.
Yeah.
And so it became less acceptable than STI was because of that.
Yeah. These days, I bring my computer with me. We have a software that measures it, and I set up a microphone at different points in the theater, and it calculates it for me. It's great.
I'm sure Mr. Points will be rolling over.
Yeah. And this one is sort of the opposite to STI. This one also ranges from 0 to 1. We report it in percentage. And the lower the value, the better the room performs. So you want a high SDI, and you want a low percent alcons. And then we also look at support. It's just a measurement of how strong the reflections are off the stage to a receiver on stage. And generally, you want good support. As I said, it's really hard to play on a stage where you cannot hear the other people in your ensemble. And it's... even less so for voice. It's a little bit harder too, I think, probably to perform when you can't hear your fellow actors.
And they don't want to just put stage monitor speakers
on? No, not all. It depends on what the budget is. We work on everything from like middle school theaters to like community theaters to actual concert hall type stuff. And the budget and resources that are available are vastly different for a middle school theater versus a professional performing arts center.
And also they don't have a real operator, so the equipment wouldn't work anyway.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. One of the interesting things for designing for something like a middle school is you try to make it as foolproof as possible. Oftentimes they're trying to teach the kids how to use it, which is great, but the kids aren't going to know what to do. This is their first time. It needs to be at least a little bit foolproof.
You make sure the average age can run it.
Yeah. Although I am sure the kids still find ways around things.
Something, just give it to a kid.
Yeah, no, they're great. In some ways, it's amazing how creative they are.
It's ideal.
So, So this was a cool project we worked on. It was actually a theater restoration project. The theater, I think, was built in the 1910s, something. I don't remember the exact year. It was a really cool project. And we started off by basically just checking out the theater, taking a bunch of acoustical measurements in there, and, you know, taking our own subjective impressions of the room. One of the first things that we noticed is that this is sort of going for a shoebox style, but the ratio of length to width is pretty square. That's not generally what you're looking for. The people who are sitting in the center of the theater are kind of far away from the cheek walls. And then also the cheek walls, where you can sort of see some stairs, are kind of not really, due to like sort of the opening at the stage, it's not really at a good angle for supporting anything anyways. And then also, in conjunction with that, the ceiling height wasn't that tall. It was something like 20 feet, I want to say. So, yeah. So the poorer audience members were getting stronger reflections off the ceiling than almost any of the nearby walls, which is generally not what you're going for. You do want good supporting ceiling reflections, but you want the wall reflections to be stronger than that. And they weren't going to increase the height of the theater. I think that was the first thing we asked. That was a no-go. Yeah. So our first thought then was we need to weaken the reflections from the ceiling. And generally in a theater, we don't like to... You can use absorption for that. That's certainly a technique. We try not to. We'd much rather use diffusion. It works quite well in theaters. So we presented the architects with a couple of options. I think the most popular, you see this in a lot of theaters, are the curved reflectors. A lot of times they're used to also help direct the sound, especially if you're going to be speaking on stage unamplified. They're great for that. We came up with some shapes to do on the ceiling, some details. They eventually decided they wanted to go with the curved reflectors because they thought it kind of helped keep the overall nice look of the theater. They were trying to make as little changes visually to it as possible, and we'd come up with quite some elaborate ceiling schemes, which looked really cool, we thought, which is dangerous to say to an architect sometimes, by the way. We thought it looked really cool, but it also didn't really fit in, we admit, with like the, you know, 1910s, 1920s style that the theater was going for. So this is sort of a snapshot of some of the ray tracing we did with it. For some reason, the lighting is bright red in this. I don't know why, and I couldn't get it to change. I think we were trying to make sure that the reflectors weren't covering up the lighting for the stage. So basically, what we've done with the first two reflectors here is we're trying to have those help direct sound further back into the audience. The remaining three reflectors, as you head towards the rear, or I guess four, one of them sort of partially hidden, we're trying to sort of diffuse the sound and scatter it a little bit, break it up, make the ceiling feel like it's further away. And we, you know, tested a couple of different configurations. This is just showing a speaker on stage, and we put a random receive location in the audience. Here we were looking at to see, we had a loudspeaker in a cluster directly, sort of in that corner there. I think at the time it was intentionally hidden behind the that first reflector. The architect very much did not want anything to be visible on the project. Actually, especially the lights. We had to argue. The theater consultant had to argue with them about that because the lights weren't able to properly illuminate the stage with the reflectors blocking them.
Couldn't see or hear, so yeah,
yeah. No, it was a great theater. I think the theater consultant's final argument was that if you were ever to go see a Broadway play and you were on Broadway and you look to the side, you see the lights, and that's okay. No one goes to Broadway and is upset because they can see the lights, or hopefully no one is.
They want the sound to come from the voice of God.
Yeah,
where you can't see it but can hear it.
Yeah, so. No, this was a fun project. It came out really well. Unfortunately, I can't show pictures of the finished thing because I haven't been given permission, so I just have the ray tracing for you here, but I think that's, yeah, that covers performance halls. And then I have one more case study, and that's basically the end of my presentation if you guys want to.
Should we break?
Chuck, why don't we wrap it up if we, there's just one more, unless there's an objection to that.
Well, we want people to stay after an emission, don't we?
Well, that's...
We want to give away stuff.
I'd like to share about Audio Test Kitchen as well at some point.
Yeah.
For,
okay.
For a period of time.
Yeah. Well, then,
we can take a break.
We can take a break then.
Cool.
Yeah.
Very good.